then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's March the 10th, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
Rising of the moon, there beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune.
Just so you know, I'm actually making this part of the podcast on Monday, March the 7th, the date that Edgar Steele's trial is supposed to begin, presumably with jury selection, and at the moment, there's no news on what's happening. I'll check my sources later as I come to the end of this episode, maybe tomorrow or even Wednesday, and we'll see if there's any dramatic developments there, but the first few days of the trial will probably be fairly slow. I'm sure I'll have a lot more to say next week. The first email I'd like to respond to this week comes from a gentleman called Michael. Probably shouldn't mention his last name, and as sometimes happens, I once again have no idea where he's from, for which I apologize. Either I've forgotten or else he didn't say, and I can't remember which. Anyway, it goes, Dear HAC, I wrote a couple of days back with a few questions that I had. However, yesterday I remembered an additional question that I wished to put to you related to one of the areas touched on in my email, but which I forgot to add. The question relates as to how the Northwest American Republic will deal with the issue of corporate entities as we generally understand such to be, but also has considerable wider impact. The question is whether a law banning any form of permanent persons will exist. By the way, I know that may sound a bit odd to some of you, but I understand what he's talking about, and I'll explain in a bit. You will be aware of the effect of the Santa Clara Railway Court decision in the late 1800s that paved the way for a corporation to be classed as a person. So a person could therefore be permanent, as well as a corporate entity could then be attached to a natural person, as well as such organizations as the Federal Reserve Bank could then be incorporated and be permanent, as opposed to the system of a chartered corporate entity that existed beforehand. Of course, with a chartered entity, it has a specific chartered lifespan and purpose activity, and the owners thereof can either apply for renewal or close the entity and have the value of it distributed back to them. In short, as the law allowing permanent persons allowed the Admiralty Law structures of Zog to take full control of the populations throughout the world and use them for the issuance of their fiat currencies, this is one of the most important aspects of law relating to the concept of a corporate entity that exists, and it's signed Michael. Okay, what Michael's talking about here is something called the Sovereign Citizen Movement, which I suppose I'd better talk about a bit, because a lot of you folks have probably come across in the past. Or, if not, you'll come across it at some point in your wanderings across the internet. Now, the best way I can describe the sovereign citizens is that they're kind of right-wing anarchists, super-duper-duper libertarians who believe that the United States government is illegitimate, which of course it is and has been since 1861, and who believe that it is legally possible to become independent of the government through using various legal and bureaucratic tricks and procedures. Now, I never did get into it all that much, but I know that it has a lot to do with claiming that the American courts aren't real courts, they're admiralty courts, because the flag has a fringe on it, or doesn't have a fringe on it, I can't remember which, and there are supposed to be ways in which you can appear before a judge or a commissioner of oaths and swear an oath removing yourself from the jurisdiction of the United States and become a sovereign citizen, that kind of thing. The sovereign citizens also wage what the government refers to as quote-unquote paper terrorism by filing liens with a local clerk of court against the mayor or the chief of police or some judge they don't like or the president or whoever. And then when that person tries to sell their house, it really screws up the sale, so they've managed to piss off a lot of powerful people with money, with predictable results. They also occasionally try issuing their own fiat money, as they call it, in the form of weird bank draft-looking documents that they make themselves, and they've tried things like paying their taxes with these things and buying tractors and whatnot, which is what got the Montana Freeman in trouble back in the 90s. I mean, look, I have a lot of personal time and sympathy for anybody who wants to be free of the U.S. government, believe me. But come on now, what did they think was going to happen when they tried issuing their own money and paying real debts with it? I once knew an attorney, a pretty good one, who was quite well versed in all of this, and I asked him about it, and he told me, yeah, all this stuff is perfectly good pre-1861 constitutional law. The only trouble is that it's not 1861 anymore, and the government and the courts and the police simply aren't going to let you do it. And he told me, people have this idea that just because they're legally in the right, that means they're going to win in court, and nothing could be further from the truth, as I suspect Ed Steele is about to find out the hard way. And my lawyer friend went on to say that the best legal argument or defense in the world is no good if the judge is simply going to ignore everything you say. What do you think the Founding Fathers gave us the Second Amendment for? It wasn't to fight Indians, and it wasn't so we could go hunting every autumn and swill six packs of beer and maybe bag a deer if we're not too drunk to shoot straight. They gave us the Second Amendment so that we could deal with the very situation we have in existence today. But men like Washington and Jefferson and Franklin made the mistake of assuming that their descendants would be the same kind of men who stood at Concord Bridge and Lexington Green, and later on at Fort Sumter and Bull Run. Trouble is, we're not. You try to use the law alone to free yourself from the system without any element of armed force, and you end up like the Montana Freeman or the Weavers on Ruby Ridge or Ed and Lorraine Brown, surrounded in your home by an army of hired killers. I mean, what are you supposed to do? Run out into your yard waving a piece of paper in the air yelling, "Ha ha, you can't do this to me! I've got the deed!" In this society, the courts, the police, the FBI, and the bankers can pretty much do whatever the hell they want to anybody they want, and sometimes they do. Why shouldn't they? Nobody's going to do anything about it, and they know it. Attacking and destroying and violating the rights of white people and so-called right-wingers and sovereign citizens in this country is the safest activity the secret police can engage in. It's an easy way to rack up brownie points with D.C., and they rack up arrests that look good in their personnel jackets. Never mind messing with Mexican drug cartels, or Los Angeles gangbangers, or moonshiners, or illegal immigrant coyotes, or invading illegal aliens on the Arizona border, or bank robbers. They shoot back, so screw that. Never mind tracking down kiddie porn or pedophiles, that's too much work. And they're not allowed to go anywhere near big bankers and financial people and the real criminals in this society. Bernie Madoff was a fluke, and he'd still be out there doing his thing if he hadn't pissed off the Jews by ripping them off as well as the Goyim. If you're an FBI man, and you need to do something to justify your paycheck and get some more budget for your regional office and make big-time brown nose points with the Bureau, find yourself a sovereign citizen living in a cabin out in the woods who hasn't paid his taxes in a few years, and surround him with your SWAT teams and drag him away for 20 years. Works like a charm every time. Okay, moving on to Michael's question about corporations, this is actually kind of interesting because the Republicans recently used this as a kind of legal jiu-jitsu to put one over on the Democrats in the Supreme Court in some landmark ruling, the name of which escapes me for the moment, and the liberals are still screaming their heads off over it. About a year ago, the Supremes ruled that a corporation is, in fact, a person in the sense that it has a legal existence and therefore has more or less the same legal rights as an individual person. And that includes the right to participate openly in the democratic process, small d, and the right to contribute money to campaigns and to create and finance political action committees. Now, the Democrats are screaming like banshees that this will open the gates of a flood of corporate money in the political process, by which, of course, they mean Republican and conservative money instead of that nice, clean Democratic Union money from the NEA and the SEIU dues and the Teamsters Pension Fund. I got news for them. The so-called political process in this country was flooded with corporate money long before this Supreme Court ruling and always has been. It's just that now they can do so openly, and we saw part of the result of this in the 2010 midterm elections when Republican candidates swept the board. Of course, the fact that the President of the United States is a socialist nigger didn't help the Democrats much either. Now, as to how the Northwest Republic will handle this situation, the first thing I'd like to do is to refer Michael and any other interested parties to the Northwest Constitution, which you can find on the party website at www.northwestfront.org. You will immediately notice several major differences between the old American system and the new one. The first and most important difference lies in the nation itself and in the nature of NAR society, which will be all white and therefore minus all the little minority and racial and left-wing pressure groups that have torn the present political system to pieces over the past century, like rats feasting off a corpse. A lot of our Constitution is, of course, designed specifically to prevent the kind of things from happening which destroyed the old America, and so much of the strength of the new Northwest nation will lie not so much in what is there, but in what is not there. The second major difference lies in the graduated franchise, which is restricted to those who have earned their voter votes through national service. In the Northwest Republic, privilege is the reward of responsibility fulfilled. The objective here is to create, as far as possible, the kind of electorate that the Founding Fathers assumed would always exist back in 1787. An intelligent, educated, and civic-minded voter base of white people who have not only demonstrated their own personal responsibility and stake in society through national service, but who have been properly educated and trained by the state in how to think instead of to feel. Hopefully with the result that it'll be a lot harder, if not impossible, for thieves and fools and bad actors of various kinds to bamboozle their way into elected office. Now finally, Northwest society will be largely administered by the party itself, who will be ideally a political, intellectual, and moral elite trained from a very young age in the arts of statecraft, politics, administration, and government. Now, these things will be taught as high-level disciplines, just like engineering or pure science or music and the arts. Oh, yeah, there'll be a constant battle to keep the party itself up to the mark on those fronts, and to make sure that we don't degenerate into a corrupt, privileged bureaucracy like happened in the old Marxist states, Soviet Union, and whatnot during the past century. But we're not Marxists. Corruption is not inherent in our system, and I believe that with a constant and vigilant awareness of the potential problem, we can do it. Now, what I'm saying here is that the present-day connection between elected office and business and money will be largely absent in the Northwest American Republic. The economy will be important, true, but our ultimate goal must be to create a world containing only the most basic organic classes of people, almost a modern version of ancient Rome or the medieval world in nature, i.e. the soldier, the scientist and technician as opposed to the church and the professional clergy who are specifically banned, the worker and the artisan, the father and mother and the nuclear family unit. Not only will certain parasitic and detrimental classes of people disappear, such as lawyers and professional clergy, but the businessman and the financier and the corporation will be removed as much as possible from any position of power and influence. Because when a society starts making decisions and taking courses of action and development based on money and material things instead of moral and racial considerations, that's when and where it starts to go off the rails. That's what happened to Western civilization long ago in our history, basically, when Renaissance Europe allowed the Jews to get into banking and introduce the usury system. And it's what we can't allow to happen in the Northwest. I know this may not sound like a very clear answer to your question, Michael, but what I'm trying to say here is that the Northwest Republic will not be a return to Beaver Cleaverville in any sense of the term, and that includes the economic sense when small-town America was run by the Chamber of Commerce. I always believe that in the final analysis, it was not the Supreme Court or the NAACP or the FBI or the federal government that finally integrated the South back in the 50s and 60s. The South was integrated by the Chamber of Commerce, the Baptist businessmen in suits who decided that all this racial talk and racial trouble was bad for business. They wanted nice, happy, contented niggers and nice, happy, contented white folks all trooping downtown to the Woolworths and the Sears and Roebuck and the Piggly Wiggly on Saturday afternoon and putting all their money into the pockets of the Baptist boys in the suits and the ties. not cross burnings and race riots and sit-ins and civil rights marches and all that kind of distraction. In the Northwest Republic, we are going to create a completely different order of society. None of these factors are going to apply, Michael. We're not going to simply go back to the capitalist and materialist past like a dog returning to its vomit. We damn well better not do that. But in any case, all this is moot. We still have that little revolution thing to get through first, remember, before we can start talking about all this stuff. Next email is from a comrade named Hank, and once again, I can't seem to find anything in the email that tells me where he's from, and I can't remember. This senility thing is getting to be a damn nuisance. Anyway, Hank asks a question, which I get fairly often, and the question goes as follows. Dear Mr. Covington, I bought The Brigade, A Distant Thunder, The Hill of the Ravens, and A Mighty Fortress on Amazon, and I was wondering in what order they should be read to get the correct timeline for the story of the Northwest Republic. Thank you for your help, Hank. Okay, there's two ways that you can read the Northwest Independence novels, and the first is in the order in which they were written, which is The Hill of the Ravens, A Distant Thunder, A Mighty Fortress, and The Brigade last. Now, the second way you can read them is in what might be called mythos order, which is almost the exact opposite. You start with The Brigade, then A Distant Thunder, then A Mighty Fortress, then The Hill of the Ravens. Now, for a new reader, I recommend the second way, although it does mean you have to tackle the longest and thickest novel first. You have to bear in mind the way in which the Northwest novels came into existence. In the year 2000, after Morris Deese did what he did to Pastor Butler, I made a couple of promises to myself. The first was that I would personally quit screwing around. I would leave Texas. I would go to the Northwest myself and initiate a serious Northwest independence movement, if nothing else, in honor of Pastor Butler. And the second thing I decided I was going to do was I was going to use my writing talents to write a novel about a future Northwest Republic and what it might be like. And that turned out to be The Hill of the Ravens. Now, because The Hill of the Ravens was written first, a lot of people find that there's some stuff in there that strikes them as a bit odd, and it's not quite in sync with the rest of the series, and that's true. But what happened was the series just kind of grew. I originally intended to write only one Northwest novel, and then I kept getting demands for more and more and more. And I noticed that there was a lot of things in The Hill of the Ravens that I hadn't really covered. And at that point, the whole Northwest mythos, if you want to call it that, the NVA, et cetera, just sort of took on a life of its own. And so there's various little odd things in the books that don't quite seem to fit in. And that's probably because, as you have to bear in mind, these books came into existence over a period of about 8 years. And now I'm working on number 5, which is probably going to take another 2 years or so. So what we'll have in the long run is a series of books that took about 10 years to completely compose and publish. And so there's going to be a little bit of difficulty sort of making them all hang together. But anyway, we won't get into that. Right, first music break. I got some good feedback last week on the piece that I played from Sean Davey from the album Grunuala about Grace O'Malley, the Pirate Queen of Ireland. Not so much on the song itself, but because people like that combination of Celtic traditional music and modern orchestration. Now, there are indeed a lot of Irish and Scottish traditional musicians who have teamed up over the past few decades with proper symphonic groups, and they've produced some pretty exciting music, not only as individual pieces and symphonies and whatnot, but as movie soundtracks, Titanic and Braveheart being two good examples. I think probably the best thing of this kind that I've heard is an album I've got called The Relief of Derry Symphony from Northern Ireland, which unfortunately I can't play for you because it's in 4 movements and they're all too long for this program. But there are a number of good combined traditional and orchestral pieces. This is one called Chasing the Fox. This is the Cincinnati Pops Orchestra along with the Chieftains. Thank you.
what's the tomorrow, sir, pray? What is that you're rating? A fine fat goose I stole from you, would you like to come and taste it? Madarina ruatha fairly clua, madarina ruatha brahma, madarina rua in the lease of lua, her is barga fluish in north. And
madarina ruatha fairly clua, madarina ruatha brahma, madarina rua in the lease of lua.
Okay, it's now Tuesday afternoon, and as promised, back to developments in the Edgar Steele case. It looks now as if my decision not to try and attend the opening of the trial in person was correct, because, as I predicted might be possible, there was no trial yesterday. At the last minute, the federal judge has reversed himself and allowed the defense attorneys not only a change of venue, but also a continuance until next month, so I saved myself a trip to Coeur d'Alene. This is an interesting development. It could be that being a former federal prosecutor, Ed's new defense attorney has tipped the judge the wink that this one may go south for Uncle Sam. And if he doesn't want egg dripping all over his face, he'd better get it the hell out of his courtroom and slough it off onto some other judge. On the downside, Ed was not allowed a change of venue out of state, which is bad. But at least he was able to get out of northern Idaho, where Tracy Whelan won't be able to wave the Aryan Nations flag in front of a jury full of Daryl and his other brother Daryl and talk about how embarrassing all this Idaho racism is. The trial of Edgar Steele is now scheduled to take place in Boise on April the 26th. Now, he may be able to get a better jury in Boise, he may not. Don't know the town that well. Although I was there last May, and I was very impressed with it. Good destination for those of you who are considering immigrating to the homeland. It's kind of like Southern California was when Southern California was still nice and livable. The defense did confirm yesterday that they are in fact going to challenge the authenticity of the infamous tapes wherein Edgar Steele supposedly tries to hire the schlub Larry Fairfax as a hitman. Now, I say tapes, although in actual fact I doubt they're actually tapes. They're probably digital recordings. According to the Coeur d'Alene Press, a Dr. George Pepkin has already examined copies of the recordings for the defense and pronounced them bogus and altered. I think it's significant that the originals of the recordings are being held at the FBI lab in Quantico, and this expert Dr. Papkin may have to travel to Virginia to examine them because the FBI apparently does not intend to return the originals to Idaho for the trial, which I think tells us something right there. It tells us that the Bureau has something to hide. Well, surprise, surprise, Sergeant Carter! The Bureau has had something to hide ever since J. Edgar Hoover was attending cocktail parties in New York back in the 1950s, dressed as a woman and calling himself Mary, along with the Jewish homosexual Roy Cohn, and no, I'm not making that up. Anyway, more on the Edgar Steele case as it develops in the future. Okay, back to the emails. This one is from Ron in Richmond, Virginia. Dear Harold, I have a question concerning the Radio Free Northwest podcast on the 20th of January of this year. You mentioned some books for organizers to buy, such as The Irish War of Independence, and yet you hesitated to name communist revolutionary books or how-to manuals because many members may not want to touch anything with the taint of communism. The way I see it, many new strategies and tactics have to be taken from other more successful groups because of our own movement's failure. If the tools or communist techniques work, then they should be used. If you would kindly give me the list of those titles, I'd be very grateful. I currently have communist works such as The Revolutionary Catechism by Sergei Nechayev, which you referred to in last week's broadcast, and which you are correct in asserting is a very powerful document spiritually, but that is a psychological piece, not a how-to manual. Anything you can send when you have the time would be seriously appreciated. Okay, Ron, I'll give you a brief rundown of some communist Marxist books I recommend that our people read for their practical content, if not for their ideological bent. First off, I recommend The Diary of Che Guevara and Guevara's earlier work, a book entitled Guerrilla Warfare. Oddly enough, I just lent out my own copy of Guerrilla Warfare this weekend. By reading both, you can examine what worked for Castro during the Cuban Revolution itself in the late 1950s, and what failed for Guevara when he attempted to do an encore in Bolivia 10 years later. Secondly, I recommend a book entitled 150 Questions for a Guerrilla by General Alberto Bayo, or Bayo, B-A-Y-O, not quite sure how that's pronounced. He was a former Republican general from the Spanish Civil War who fled to South America and became Castro's military mentor. It's kind of hard to learn guerrilla warfare from a book, but insofar as that is possible, this is a good book to start with. Next up, I recommend a book I have in my own library entitled Conspirator, The Story of Lenin in Exile by a Jew named Helen Rappaport. This tells the story of how the Bolsheviks operated on a day-to-day basis during the last 10 years before the 1917 revolution. It's always very difficult and sometimes just plain wrong to draw historical parallels too closely, but I believe that of all the revolutions in the past 200 years, the two that run the closest parallel and show the most similarity to the situation that we face in the Northwest today are the Irish War of Independence in the 1920s, that's for the tactical situation, the idea of a successful colonial war to force an occupying power to withdraw, and the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 as far as facing down a government with a level of corruption and incompetence and susceptibility to overthrow, if you get my meaning. The closest, I think, that corresponds to the situation we face in the United States today as far as our enemy goes, by way of corruption, incompetence, and so forth, is that of Tsarist Russia 100 years ago. The book Conspirator is especially good because it deals with just that subject, how to be a revolutionary conspirator, how to use what Lenin and the Bolsheviks referred to as the conspiratorial method of organizing, of communicating, of maintaining oneself in the face of secret police, persecution, so forth and so on. It worked for the Bolsheviks, and with some adaptation to modern times, it can work for us. Now, finally, there's a work I'm going to recommend here which will freak out everybody concerned who knows anything about it. The book is called Witness by a man named Whitaker Chambers, and the mere mention of his name is usually enough to send screams of horror arising to the heavens from all quarters. Chambers was the former American communist who testified against Alger Hiss, the Soviet spy, back in the 1940s. But it also details Chambers' life in the Communist Party during the 1920s and 30s, and later on in the Soviet espionage apparatus in this country, together with a lot of information as to how they operated back then. Secret mail drops, contacts, the way a spy network was organized, the way an underground printing press or other operation would be organized, so forth and so on. Now, if you know anything about left-wing liberal history in this country, you will know that to this day, the Hiss case is considered to be kind of a litmus test of left-wing orthodoxy here, along with Seiko and Vanzetti and the Rosenbergs. Now, in lefty lib circles, to this very day, if you even so much as hint at the mere possibility that any of these people might even have been partially guilty of the crimes that they were charged with, you will be excommunicated from the lefty lib faith with bell, book, and candle and cast into outer darkness. Hiss, Seiko, and Vanzetti and the Rosenbergs are lefty lib saints, and questioning them is on a par with denying the Holocaust. Now, Chambers went way off the reservation here, actually cooperating with the much-hated and much-abused House Un-American Activities Committee, and also a young congressman named Richard Nixon, and helping to send Alger Hiss, the most highly placed Soviet spy in American history, to prison for perjury. So you can imagine how the lefty libs feel about him even to this day. Now, granted, Whitaker Chambers was no prize. He wasn't one of us, and none of our people have much cause to like him either. For one thing, he was married to a Jew. And for another thing, when he renounced communism, he didn't become a nationalist or even a conservative. He became a Quaker of all the ridiculous things, which is kind of a religious version of Marxism in any case. Also, by way of full disclosure, I should mention that Chambers was accused on numerous occasions of being a faggot by a lot of people, including both the Communist Party USA, who were trying to discredit him, and the FBI, who basically, I think, just didn't like him. But I've never seen that accusation leveled by anyone whom I would consider to be a reliable source, and I have never seen any proof or evidence that Chambers was an actual practicing sodomite. He did admit to having mental and emotional problems when he was young, caused by the suicide of his brother, which is one of the things that drove him into the Communist Party. And he admits in his book that at one point the attacks and the vilification directed against him in the left-wing liberal media of the time drove him to the point where he was considering suicide. However, the main reason I am recommending Whitaker Chambers' Witness as a book that I think we need to read is that it's probably one of the best accounts I have ever read of how it is at least possible for a white man or woman, no matter how depraved, to awaken from the left liberal Jew madness. And if not exactly do a 180 and fight for truth, justice, and the Hitler way, then at least admit that they were wrong about the whole left liberal Jew shtick. Basically, it is possible for white people to think their way out of this mental swamp, even when they're pretty deep in. Chambers was in about as far as it's possible to get, and yet he was able to think his way out. And not only is Witness just plain fascinating as an autobiography, but I think it's a cautionary tale for us against giving up on our fellow white people, as we're all too prone to do. Sometimes they do manage to break away from the Pied Piper, and after some wandering around, they find their way out of the woods, and I think we need to remember that. We need to provide some kind of alternative and develop some kind of protocol for taking in and debriefing and motivating white people from the middle class and the so-called normal world who wander into our ranks in a daze from out of the dark woods, so to speak, having just escaped from the Pied Piper or the Wicked Witch with a gingerbread house who wanted to eat them. Because more and more people like that are going to break away in the coming years, and they're going to need some place to go. I think Whitaker Chambers' book Witness, if read and understood correctly, will impart to us that little bit of compassion necessary not just to write everybody else off. Okay, maybe that's getting a little too arcane for you guys. Anyway, next email from Tom in Jacksonville. Dear HAC, something slipped my mind when a few weeks back you were talking about the number of items distributed while quote-unquote littering and the number of interested whites that make contact, and that's my own results for similar activity. I have been making thousands of racist music CD information discs, something I consider to be a really slick product, that have been distributed all over the country. Each one contains the purpose-created email address for contacting me. I have so far not received one email in reply to a distributed disc. Not one in the 2 years that I've been doing this. Fair enough. But that doesn't mean that this effort has been a total waste. I guesstimate that a third of the discs are never listened to, either the long route or the short route to the trash. A third more are listened to, but never put in a computer to access the files. Of the third that are explored, only 10% of the people will take the information seriously. So maybe 33 people out of 1,000 really get the message. For me, that's enough to keep going. Signed, Tom. Well, Tom, good for you. And if you can refresh my senile memory and send me your email address again, I'll mention it on the next RFN. And let's see if we can't get some demand for those CDs of yours. By the way, guys, what I said about littering a few episodes ago, i.e. literature distribution generating roughly one contact per 5,000 pieces distributed, now that's my experience with literature distribution. And bear in mind that that experience is almost 30 years old. It may well be that we were doing it wrong, or we were just unlucky, or maybe our material was boring, or otherwise no good, or whatever. Now, it may well be that some of you guys out there have had much better results than the old NSPA did with literature distribution. And if that's the case, then lay it on me, or better yet, make your own MP3 sound file and tell us about it yourselves. Tell us about your experience with literature distribution. I'll be glad to play it on here. Okay, time for another Celtic orchestral music break. Yet another Sean Davey symphony, dating from the early 1980s, is one called The Brendan Voyage, about the Irish monks who, according to legend, were actually the first to sail to the New World in curraghs, or skin boats, led by a monk named Brendan. This is the final cut from The Brendan Voyage, where the monks at long last get their first sight of the New World. It's called Newfoundland. Got another economic question from Jesse from Alaska. Dear HAC, can you explain how the banking system in the Northwest Republic would work without interest? Okay, many years ago, I wrote an article entitled 14th Century Economics Lesson, in which I explained how the first modern financial and banking system, as we understand the term, came about, and how it ended up getting replaced with the Jewish usury system. I won't sit here and read that article out because it's too long, but I'll summarize it as best I can. Our present form of usury-generated finance capitalism and banking arose in the Middle Ages and the early Renaissance period, and contrary to popular belief, the Jews did not invent banking. The first bankers in the modern sense were Italians, centered mostly in Florence and Venice and Milan, and they were referred to then and by historians now as the Lombard bankers. And yes, I know Florence is in Tuscany, but what can I tell you? They were called Lombards back then, and they are now, just one of those things. Money was first invented as a substitute for barter, and for millennia, it consisted only of gold, silver, and occasionally copper or bronze coins. Now, eventually, as trade expanded, money became too cumbersome and dangerous to go on a trading expedition lugging long mule trains loaded down with gold coin. So, with the establishment of the first medieval banks, the paper bank draft was invented, which allowed a merchant in London, say, to travel to Paris carrying only a document instead of heavy bags of money, which were so tempting to bandits and the local robber baron and whatnot, and he could do his business, deposit his profits in the Paris branch of the Bardi or whoever, and then draw them out again from the London branch when he got home. Now, this was the first paper money, and it was specific. It was like a check made out to only one person. Now, you need to understand that although Karl Marx was full of sheep dip, he did recognize and articulate certain correct and vitally important things about the nature of capitalism. The capitalism is utterly dependent on the exploitation of human beings for their labor, as opposed to the free enterprise system. And in order to function, capitalism has to reinvent man as a commodity, an economic unit of production and consumption, just like Marxism, both of which are, by the way, Jewish concepts. Secondly, capitalism is dependent for the generation of more capital, not only on profit, but on the highly cost-effective form of profit known as usury, which is the collection of interest on loaned money. Long ago, people recognized the destructive potential of usury, and for centuries it was forbidden by the church to Christians, which used to be pretty much the same thing as saying Arians. Only Jews were allowed to lend money at interest for many, many centuries. So, how did the economy work in the days before usury? Okay, let's say we're in Venice, which is a great trading city, about the year 1396. Now, usury is forbidden to everyone except the Jews, and their interest rates are as high as 50%, so nobody but a drunk or a lunatic deals with them anyway. The Jews exist on interest mostly off the very poor, as pawnbrokers. And in those days, the Catholic Church even established a series of interest-free co-op religious pawn shops to try and protect the poor from the bloodsuckers. But let's say you're a merchant, and you still have to finance your business ventures, so how do you go about it? Okay, let's say you got a ship. Now you want to send it to Constantinople full of Italian goodies, cloth, worked metal goods, glassware, wool, so forth and so on. And you want to bring the same ship back full of Oriental goodies, like spices, mahogany, Turkish rugs, etc. Now, let's assign an arbitrary cost to this whole deal of 10,000 gold ducats, which was the unit of coin in medieval Venice. You believe that the profit from the sale of your goods in Constantinople and the resale of their goods in Venice will yield 20,000 ducats, and for the sake of argument, we'll accept that as accurate. That'll make our figures nice and simple to deal with. Okay, so where do you get the money? Now, you can put up the entire 10 grand yourself if you're filthy rich. And a lot of the wealthiest merchant adventurers did just that, as well as putting up their lives. A lot of these guys weren't just businessmen, remember. They were sea captains, and they commanded their own vessels. They can opt to take all the risk if they want, including the risk of the ship sinking or getting captured by pirates, and then they can take all the profit. Or they can look for investors to share the risk. Now, our hypothetical merchant goes to one or more of the great Lombard banking houses, the Bardi, the Pazzi, the Strozzi, the Albizzi, or the Medici. Now, these banks are mostly centered in Florence or Siena, but they have branches all over Europe. Our guy goes to the banks, and most likely several of them, because they'll be more likely to back him if their individual exposure is less. He explains his venture, And he shows them the ship so that they know it's a good, stout, seaworthy vessel. He lets them know he'll be captaining the voyage himself. And he points out he's got a good track record of prosperous expeditions prior to this. And so he looks good to these lumbered banker guys. And so they lend him the dough. Now, the total outlay for the project, remember, is 10 grand in gold pieces. Now, the merchant himself puts up 4,000 ducats, or 40%. The Bardi, the Strozzi, and the Medici banks say we'll put up 2,000 each. Now, they know that they'll have to wait 1 year for the ship's return to find out how they did. Now, this is the origin of the old expression, when my ship comes in. Now, you begin to see a little bit of difference here, Jesse, between this and usury. This system is based on an actual cut of a profit, not just money making more money. Anyway, if everything goes according to plan, the goods that come on the ship will be sold for 20,000 gold ducats, and that recoups everybody's initial investment, and it leaves 10 grand profit. The merchant will take 4 grand of the surplus, and the three banks get 2 grand each, and that's 100% return on their investment. That's good business. And something comes of it when those who can afford it buy the goods who were imported from the East and the overall standard of living in Venice is raised. This very type of deal is how Venice got so prosperous to begin with and stayed so for all those centuries. Of course, it was all a lot more complicated than that. Now, for instance, in many cases the ship's captain, if he wasn't the owner, would have a substantial share, and the crew would be paid not only a minimum wage but a small share each as well. Plus, there was taxes and overhead just like there is today, but you get the idea. Now, a rich merchant might send out, say, 10 ships a year under this system. 3 would be lost, but 7 of them would return, and that leaves him an overall profit. Now, I say again, do you note the difference between this system and Jewish usury? The Lombard banking system was based on productivity for profit, whereas the Jewish usury system is a shell game where money multiplies by itself without relation to anything in the real world. Money under the old system was earned by buying actual things of value low and selling high, or by making something, or building something to sell, or undertaking risks to obtain something that was material and tangible, something you could see, feel, touch, eat, or drink, wear on your body, whatever. There are endless variations on this. Money was lent for agriculture, to build a factory or a workshop, to build a road, whatever, but always it was something you could touch, feel, taste, and use or consume. Money did not magically produce money out of nothing as it does with usury. Now, I won't get into this much more because I described the usury system and how it works several weeks ago in an earlier podcast. But the point I'm trying to make here, Jesse, is that interest is not necessary for business and an economy to flourish. We did without it before, and we can do without it again. In fact, the Northwest Constitution specifically prohibits interest. As to the question of how would a bank make a profit if it couldn't loan money at interest, well, who said the purpose of a bank should be making a profit? In fact, who says the whole purpose of life is to make a profit, which seems to have been the overall American and Western attitude for several hundred years? Now, there are certain professions which fall into the category of community service, very useful and valuable and badly needed professions, I might add. Doctors are a good example. The white community needs doctors, and in return, they have the right to respect, a certain amount of privilege and social standing, I can see that, and the right to make a fairly good living off the service they provide to others, certainly good enough to support their families in comfort. No argument there. But doctors do not have the right to drive Porsches and buy a new SUV every year, nor do they have the right to charge a sick or injured man $1,500 for an ambulance ride to the hospital, nor do they have the right to take somebody's house because grandma gets sick, nor do they have the right to ration and withhold necessary health care on the grounds of money, which is the situation which presently exists in this country. Lawyers are another example of the profit motive gone mad, in this case a profession which will be completely prohibited under the Republic, because their purpose in life is to make a monetary profit off human misery that's caused whenever any white person has any contact with our so-called law and our so-called judicial system, and that's vile. Now, they would claim that the law is so complex and the court system is so huge and cumbersome and inefficient that the ordinary person needs help and guidance through the system, and that's true. But the solution to that problem lies not in millions of lawyers, and apparently there are actually literally millions of the bastards these days, but in making the law so simple that you don't need an attorney. I'll give you another example. Take full-time priests and ministers and other clergy, another banned profession under our new Northwest Constitution. If somebody wants to get up in church on Sunday and preach the Word or teach the Bible in a Sunday school or counsel people of his own faith in various spiritual matters, fine. Nobody in the Northwest Republic is going to stop him. But he does not have some kind of right to make a profit off such services, because history and long experience have told us that a professional clergy is a dangerous thing to have around. You let them do it full time and give them a paycheck and a vicarage or a bishop's palace to live in, then they have too much time on their hands and they start meddling in things that are none of their business. Now, here's another case where the right to make a profit will be subordinated to the common good. Now, George Bernard Shaw once said that society should protect the citizen from both the burglar and the banker. Now, a banker has the right to draw a paycheck for his services. No one's arguing with that. Say he's a bank president, maybe his salary can equal a small fraction of his total deposits, something like that. But he does not have the right to enslave others with a credit card charging 29% per annum interest, like some do today. Now, I understand that a bank has to be more than a big vault with huge stacks of money in it where people keep their savings, and that it's not necessarily a good idea to let the community's whole savings reserve just sit there idle. Money does need to be out there circulating. If everybody just spent a little money on food and rent and kept all the rest of it stuffed in a mattress like Ebenezer Scrooge, doing nothing, then there would be no economy to speak of. But the banker in the Northwest Republic can find other ways to keep that money circulating and, yes, make a profit for his bank sufficient to pay his own salary and those of his employees. He might start by emulating the old Lombard bankers and lending money for business ventures in exchange for a specific cut of the profits, which is not the same thing as pure interest, because it's based on something actually being done or made or produced. I personally see no need for more than two or three banks in the Republic. A straight savings bank where people can put their money instead of in their mattress, where it might get burned up in a fire. An agricultural bank that specializes in farm loans based on a cut of the crop's profits. And something like a European Building Society that would make interest-free home loans, especially to young married couples just starting out. But hey, that's just me. Jesse, let me cogitate on this, and maybe I'll have a little more to say about it next week or in Freedom's Sons. In the meantime, third music break. Celtic music isn't just orchestrated these days in orchestras, so to speak. There's a lot of rock groups out there, and there is in fact a whole subgenre of Gaelic, Welsh, and Breton rock music. This is the Scottish rock group Runrig. I'm going to see if I can go straight ad lib here now in reference to something that I get asked fairly often, and that's when people come to me and they say, Harold, come on, level with us. What's the plan? I mean, there is a plan, isn't there? Surely you've got some magic beans in your pocket, or you've got a magic wand stash somewhere that you're going to wave and just make it all happen. Well, yeah, there is a plan, in fact, and yes, I do mean something specific. I'd like to implement it as soon as possible. Well, the trouble is that it involves two things happening out here in the real world and not online in the imaginary world of cyberspace. And that is that we have to get a few more boots on the ground here, where I am, and we have to raise some money and establish a financial base of support so that once we get this show on the road, we can keep it there. And once I make a commitment to get something done in the name of the Northwest Front, we can keep that commitment. One of the worst and most sloppy-ass, slapdash things that the movement traditionally does is that we start these big, grandiose projects with a lot of fanfare, usually on the internet, and then either the money never materializes, or else after a few months everybody loses interest and wanders off looking for fresh entertainment. I am bound and determined that the Northwest Front is going to break that cycle of short attention span and doing things all sloppy and American and half-assed. Basically, it involves establishing a proper general headquarters unit for the NF to include a building, a proper sound studio where we can do a for-real internet radio show at least 5 times a week, possibly on our own servers. A proper propaganda department, producing, among other things, stickers, little business cards, small handheld items, and a tabloid newspaper printed in bulk for mass distribution and recruiting here in the homeland, plus all the other appurtenances of a real political movement. Now, can that still be done, even with the bad economy and all? Sure it can, but it can't be done by just one man with a computer. I need not just more boots on the ground, but I need people with specific skill sets, which they are willing to put at the service of their race for an indefinite period of time, for the duration of the conflict, as they used to say back when he joined up in World War II. Now, is this ever going to happen? I don't know. That's not my department. I can keep on talking at you every week here on the net, and I can keep on writing, and really that's about all one man can do until a small number of you decide to take this sufficiently seriously to get your ass out here. The main problem, of course, is that you have to do it on your own bat. Leaving aside for the moment the issue of whether we should provide a bunkhouse and a fridge full of beer, the fact is that right now we can't. And all I can do is keep on sitting here like I've been doing for the past 9 years, begging and pleading and ranting and raving and hoping that one day I can find the right words to get you to pack that moving van and come here, where you're supposed to be. Right now, that's all I can do. But to answer the question, yeah, there is a plan. And as soon as I can get a small amount of actual physical help, we'll start in on it. Let me know when that's going to be, will you? Because I'm looking forward to it. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.